You want to turn to the book of 1 Chronicles.
We'll begin in chapter 7,
finish chapter 6. Last time that we studied this together, I have to tell you, honestly, chapter 7 and 8 have very little in them that's of great significance to us today. But we might want to mark a couple of things just for the sake of being able to go back and look at it if we ever need to. In chapter 7 and verse 1, it says, "Now the sons of Issachar." Remember, Issachar was one of Jacob's children. That's one of the 12 tribes. You might want to just underline Issachar there. And then down in verse 6, it says, "The sons of Benjamin." So you might want to underline Benjamin there so that you know some of his children. I tell you, I think they had some stranger names for children back then than we have today. And we've got some strange ones today, so. They did have some odd names. Some of those don't even know how to begin to pronounce some of these names. They're very difficult, and they're some of them very long as well. Down in verse 13, the sons of Naphtali. Of course, Naphtali, another one of Jacob's sons, another of the tribes. And then in verse 14, the sons of Manasseh. Remember, Manasseh was not one of Jacob's sons, but one of Joseph's sons. Joseph's oldest son, in fact. And then down in verse 20, the sons of Ephraim. Remember, Ephraim was Joseph's other son, the younger son. Then down in verse 30, the sons of Asher. So I'm going to underline Asher there. I think we did as we went along, I hope at least that we did when we were going through chapter 6. We underlined Levi back there and underlined in chapter 5, Gad and Reuben. And then back in chapter 4, Simeon. And Judah, and so we see all of them being listed and their descendants. And what we really see from this is that this is God's way of showing us that this group of people is important to Him. He kept track of these people. He kept track of who was descended from who in this group because He was going to use these people for a very special purpose. You know, most of us probably couldn't name our great-great-grandparents. We don't know a lot of times who they were. Now, some people pay closer attention to their ancestors and things, and that's fine. But a lot of us, you know, we know our grandparents and maybe our great-grandparents, but you get back very far. We don't remember them at all. But in the Bible, we see whole generation after generation after generation just name after name of this person was the father of this one and the father of this one and the father of this one. For hundreds of years, they kept these genealogies so that they could trace back. And the reason they did that, we see over in the Gospels. When Jesus confronts these people, they say, "We have Abraham as our father." That's the reason they were keeping track of it. That wasn't the reason God wanted to keep track of it, but that's why they wanted to be able to prove that they were children of Abraham as though that was somehow going to make them special people. And of course, God did choose Abraham's descendants to bring Christ into the world. But now, who our ancestors were is not nearly as important as who we are. It doesn't matter if my great-great-grandma was a member of the Church of Christ or if my great-great-grandfather founded 50 different congregations in a particular state. If I'm not faithful, it doesn't matter. It's not going to make a bit of difference to me. So we see them keeping up with these things, and for a reason. They wanted to know that they were descended from Abraham. But now we see that we're descended from Abraham not in a physical sense, but in a spiritual sense. We are children of Abraham by faith. Just as he was a child of God by faith, then we can be his descendants as a result of our faith. Now, I know we've already underlined Benjamin back in chapter 7 and verse 6, but as we come to chapter 8 and verse 1, we want to underline Benjamin there again in verse 1, and then we want to look all the way down. As I said, it says, so-and-so begets so-and-so, and so on and so forth, and it lists several generations here from Benjamin, who was alive at the time that the Israelites went into Egypt. And, of course, the Israelites were in Egypt for 400 years, and or give or take a few, some say 430 or whatever, with different, trying to figure out exactly how long. But about 400 years they were there. And then they came out and they wandered around the wilderness and they had judges over them for a few hundred years as well. And then, now we come to the first king, and we want to look down to verse 33. Verse 33 of chapter 8, it says, "And Ner begat Kish, and Kish begat Saul. And Saul begat Jonathan, Malchishua, and Abinadab, and Eshbaal," or Eshbaal. And so here we see Saul, the first king, mentioned. And his genealogy is mentioned. And he came from the tribe of Benjamin. Smallest of tribes, Saul called it himself. He said, "I am from the smallest of tribes, and I am the smallest family in my tribe." He said, I'm a nobody when he was picked. But he quickly became a somebody, and then he got the big head. And once he got the big head, he started thinking he could do things without God's permission and without following God's law, and that got him into serious trouble. But here we see him being mentioned and his genealogy. And that was very important for them. That's going to be important. Also, the king of Judah, after Saul, the kings that come from the tribe of Judah. And that's a very important line, because remember that it's through that tribe of Judah that Christ came. Through David and his descendants. And Christ was going to come out of that line. If the tribe of Benjamin had continued to be the kings, then God would have had to work things differently in order for Christ to come from the kingly tribe, but he brought him through the tribe of Judah, and the tribe of Judah was the one that remained the king. He was going to allow Saul to have a descendant on the throne forever. He told him, "I'm going to raise you up as king, and if you're faithful to me, then your sons are going to, but Saul wasn't faithful to him. Saul didn't do what he should have done, and so he lost the chance. In chapter 9, that's all we really want to look at in chapter 8, see that Benjamin, the first king, came from the tribe of Benjamin. Chapter 8, I want to look at verse 28. This is talking about the tabernacle, or they also, the tent of meeting, or whatever they might have called it. But this precursor, I guess you could say, of the temple. This was where they worshipped, where the priests made the sacrifices before the time that the temple was built. While they were wandering in the wilderness, they could pick this tabernacle or tent up and pack it up and move it from one place to another and set it up and so forth. Verse 28 says, "And certain of them had the charge of the ministering vessels, that they should bring them in and out by tail." In other words, that they were going to keep account and keep a record of how these vessels, when they went out to be used, and then when they came back in after they were used. Now we might think that's a very small, insignificant, meaningless task. But God saw it important enough that He set some of the Levites, some of the priestly tribe, over that particular thing. And He said, "This is your job." That was their whole job. That was all they did, was they kept track of the vessels when they went out and when they came back in, and made sure that the same number that went out came back in. They kept track of it. That was their whole job. They were just counting the vessels. And the vessels, of course, were plates, bowls, different utensils that they used for the sacrifices and so forth. But I want us to think about that today. You know, there are some people that complain because they feel like they don't have an important task to do in the church. They feel like I just don't have the skills to do certain things. I can't teach. I can't do this. I can't do that. And so they feel like they don't have an important role in God's church. I imagine this group of people might have felt that way. All we're supposed to do is just count these things when they come in and out and keep a record of it? kind of job is that? That's not important. That's nothing. Anybody can do it. We can let the kids do that. That's not. But God said it was important. And it was so important to God that He gave that task to one group of the priestly tribe. And He said, this is your task. There was another one in verse 27 that there were four porters. They call them in verse 26, four men, I assume men, and it didn't really say, but most of the time the men were always the ones that did things in the worship to God. But these four chief porters, as they're called in verse 26, verse 27 says, they had the charge, this was the charge that was upon them, the opening of the chambers and the treasuries every morning, and that was it. That's what they did. Every morning they opened it up, just unlocked the doors and let the people, you know, to come in to give or whatever they might be coming in to do, to worship. That was their job, just open the doors. And again, we might think, what an insignificant job. Just go unlock the door, just open the door, open it up to let anybody come. But God thought it was important enough that He set four people. I mean, four. He didn't even think it'd take four folks to unlock a door, but He thought it was important enough. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that we may not be doing something that we think is just extremely important in the church. But if God has set that as something that needs to be done, He thinks it's important. We have all sorts of things that have to be done for the running of the church that some people might not think of as important. Who cleans the building? Who prepares the Lord's Supper? Some people say, well, that's no big deal. Well, anybody could do that. Well, yes, anybody could do some of those things, but not anybody does. There's the old saying about everybody knew that anybody could do the thing that nobody did. Now, if somebody had only done the thing that anybody could do, but that nobody did, then somebody would have done what everybody should have done. See, there's a lot of times when nobody does something, and when we see something that needs to be done, we can jump in there and we can do it, and it may be a small thing. But how small is it? Somebody's got to unlock the doors and lock the doors and turn on the lights and turn off the lights and all of these things. Somebody has to do all these little things that we think, oh, that's not important. But you know what? It is. I was looking today as I was standing at the back and noticing that before our gospel meeting, it would have been good. I didn't think to do it. It would have been good if we had gotten more of the registration cards for our visitors. But in the pews, many of the pews are empty of those cards. Now, we've got some in there, but just needed somebody to put them out. And that's a little thing. It's not, but I know some of the visitors may not have been able to find a card to write that they visited with us because so many of them may have been empty. See, those little things sometimes, even though we might, well, that's not a very important job. It can be a very important job. It can be very important. So we need to realize that when it comes to the church and doing things for God, there are no little jobs. Every one is an important job that accomplishes, or at least works toward accomplishing our goal of seeking and saving the lost. I'm going to look now to chapter number 10. Chapter 10, we want to look down to verses 13 and 14. Passage tells of Saul's death. We spoke of him a little bit ago, how he thought he could do things his own way. Verse 13 says, so Saul died for his transgression, which he committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord, which he kept not, and also for asking counsel of a familiar spirit to inquire of it, and inquired not of the Lord. Therefore, he slew him and turned the kingdom unto David, the son of Jesse. We remember that case where Saul disobeyed when he was told to go and to fight the battle and to destroy everything that had breath in it, everything that was alive. And when he came back, oh, he came back with the king and some of the sheep and a lot of the cattle. And Samuel said, you're supposed to destroy everything. And Saul said, well, I did just what God told me to do. And I kept some of these things back as well. But you weren't supposed to keep any of those things alive. You were supposed to kill and destroy everything for the Lord in that case. And so he just blew it by thinking that he could go on and decide to change God's law. And the same God who was angry about that, angry enough to let Saul die for that and take the whole kingdom away from him, is the same God today who teaches us some of those very same lessons, that we have got to obey him in everything, no matter how small the detail. We obey him. Chapter 11 then. David becomes king. Verse number 9. Very interesting verse. I tell you, this chapter's got some interesting things in it about, I'd like to hear some of the stories about some of these men who are mentioned in this chapter, David's mighty men. But it doesn't tell all of the stories. It tells a few. And they are some interesting stories, the things that these people were willing to risk and to do for their king. But verse number 9 says, so David waxed greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. Now why do you suppose the Lord of hosts was with him? For a very simple reason. David was with God. That's why God was with David, because David was with God. The old saying, I know you've heard it many times, that if you look around and notice that you're not near God, he's not the one that moved. Yeah. David had God with him because he had chosen to be with God. And that's something that we need to keep in mind. And David waxed greater and greater because God was with him. If we want to accomplish great things, if we want to reach our full potential as individual Christians, as a church, as well, we're going to have to do it with God's help. And we can't do it by ourselves. Then we'll look to chapter 12. We'll finish with this one this evening. Verse number 32 of chapter 12. This verse teaches us the concept, at least of an eldership, really, if we look at what it says. It says, and of the children of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, the heads of them were 200. And all their brethren were at their commandment, or under their command. So there were, in this whole tribe, I don't know how large this tribe was, Issachar, the tribe of Issachar, well, I'm not seeing the exact number in the tribe, but most of the tribes had over 20,000 people. I mean, they were large, a bit like huge, like big cities, you know, they were large groups of people. But there were 200, it says, who were men that had understanding, that knew what Israel ought to do. And they were the ones that were set up as the leaders. They were the ones who were given the command. And everyone else was under their command, or did at their commandment. Now, obviously, they didn't have the authority to change God's law, or to change any of His commands. But in areas where God had not spoken a particular thing, they were the rule. They were the authority, so to speak. And we see that same kind of a principle carried forth in the New Testament. That when we look at elders, we're supposed to set out the men who have an understanding. We don't want to get just any old guy off the street and say, oh, come in here and lead the church. No. We want somebody that's got some understanding, that knows what the church ought to do. That's who we want to have in the leadership positions, isn't it? That's who we want in charge of making those important decisions. You don't just get anybody that comes along. And there's a precedent for that right here. That's the way they did it back in the Old Testament. In Israel, they picked the men who knew what was going on. The men that knew how to lead and how to make the right decisions. Notice, it doesn't say that they chose the men who knew what Israel wanted to do. It says they chose the men there that knew what Israel ought to do. A lot of times, we elect leaders based on what we want, whether it be in the secular world or in the church as well. They'll elect and select leaders who are going to lead the church where it wants to go. And I've heard of cases where churches, the leadership of the church, the eldership of that church would put out a questionnaire to the church. Well, do you think we ought to, you know, start having a piano, or do you think we ought to start having some solos or some drama instead of preaching, or, you know, and just all sorts of things. What do y'all want? There's one church that became famous and very large, I might add as well, as a result of that. And they just went out into the city and put out a questionnaire and said, what would you like in a church? What is it you don't like about most churches, or that you would like to see in a church? And they gathered up all those questionnaires. I don't know how many they put out, probably thousands of them in this big city. And they gathered those up and they tallied it up and they said, oh, okay, well, this is what the people want. Now let's go build us a church and we'll do all these things that the people wanted. Well, that's not the way that God leads His people. That may very well be the way the devil leads his people, but that's not the way God leads his people. When God leads his people, he sets men over his church that are going to do what ought to be done. And that takes a strong character. Because it's difficult many times to do what ought to be done when that's not what everybody wants to have done. And that's a difficult thing sometimes. We'll continue on with the book of Chronicles next week. We need to think about the difference we saw between Saul, who disobeyed God, and David, who had God with him. We need to be sure that we're living our lives in such a way that we can wax greater and greater as a result of God being with us. The only way that God's going to be with us is if we're with Him. If you're here tonight and you have a need to respond to the invitation, either in initial obedience to the gospel, to put Christ on in baptism, or if as a Christian you have not been living as you should, you've been being disobedient to the gospel of Christ, to the doctrine that God would have us to hold to, you too may need to respond as we stand and as we sing.